Hey, folks, welcome back to the DC Freecast. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Vince. Zach is dead. He'll probably return from the grave at some point. But until then, we are here to talk about two comics coming out on March 12th, 2024, starting with Green Lantern number 9 by Jeremy Adams and Zermanico. This is a book that Zach brought to our attention because Zach does a thing that I never, ever do, which is as soon as the books hit our email, Zach pages through every one of them and just looks for interesting things, which is actually, it's not a bad way to be, but it winds up spoiling him all the time, whereas I am a spoiler-free boy, and so I just wait for you guys to tell me what I should be reading, and then I read it. But I'm very glad that he brought this to our attention, because this is a wild comic, Vince.
Yeah.
But it's good.
It is good. And it keeps doing the things that we like when comics do, which is, oh God, I feel like, don't anybody take this the wrong way, but like, I love when they harken back to things from like 30 or 40 years ago, right? But like, when normally when people say that, it's for the wrong reasons, right? It's like, we hate change or whatever.
Right.
No, I like when it pulls from the obscurities of DC's history. That's what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And that's what this book does.
Yeah. What this book does is it takes a really, really interesting old status quo that hasn't really been talked about in a long time. Then it takes an idea that was kind of from James Robinson's Earth 2 book that had sort of been hinted at maybe having something to do with Green Lantern for a while, but not really ever fully developed. And then it also takes a character from Far Sector, and it puts all three of those things together in a way that doesn't feel like it's comics Mad Libs, right? That's the problem sometimes, what you're talking about, Vince. When there's a creator who wants to harken back something 30 years ago, it feels like they're just thinking, well, what can I throw in here that will pop the fans, that will give them a little nudge towards, you know, their nostalgic childhood or whatever. This doesn't do any of that. This takes three sort of very separate things and puts them all together in this book in a way that makes a whole lot of sense and frankly opens a lot of interesting doors for future stories.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I hope so.
Yes, maybe. I mean, we never really know, right? But
no, we never know. For all we know, they will never mention that Tom Kalmaku was a New Guardian ever again.
Right. But he was. You know, that was.
But he was, yeah.
Yeah, there was a whole event called Millennium that was basically based around this idea. So that is the first old idea, right? The New Guardians. Now, we read Millennium. Was that our second or third Crisis Management comic?
Well, Crisis would have been first, right?
And then Legends.
Yeah. And then I believe it's Millennium, right?
Yeah. So it, certainly in the first five, maybe we're forgetting one thing.
Oh, yeah.
In there.
For sure.
But it's an event that really isn't referenced very often at DC. And the New Guardians have not been referenced in forever. And the New Guardians are not, you know, it's not like the Guardians of Oa. It's a separate thing. But not really, but kind of, you know, it's so much like, you know, blurry comics continuity stuff. But
yeah, well, DC, before you, when New Guardians is like more commonly or more recently anyway associated with Green Lantern New Guardians, which was a completely different concept.
Yes,
but I feel like DC did reuse that terminology with intention, you know, like it sounds good, and it does have a historical connection to DC, even though it's been repurposed for something else,
right?
But this is very much referencing the original, but
yes,
maybe also tying it into Green Lantern. So right.
So the New Guardians, just for folks who didn't read Millennium or whatever, the Guardians of the Universe selected these people to basically represent a superhero group that represents all of the races of Earth. Spoiler alert, it doesn't do all the races of Earth. but you know, it sort of
it did all of the ones that the creators could think of.
Yes. In the Captain Planet mold of inclusivity, it sort of is there. And then each one of the chosen people was given a power that is kind of involved with their nationality, sort of, maybe kind of, if you squint enough. But then, you know, that's basically who the new Guardians were. And Tom Kalmaku was one of the new Guardians. And here he reveals that there is a power battery on Earth, that the Earth Lanterns are specifically special, and that all of that is tied into the green. The Parliament of Trees, Swamp Thing, etc. That it's all somewhat tied into that, which is the James Robinson Earth 2 idea. That Alan Scott on Earth 2, his powers came from the green. At least partially, right? Totally? I can't remember now.
I see, the problem is I could be wrong, and it's not like we just revisited this for any project that we did not that long ago.
Patreon.com/EC3cast to learn for yourself.
But I can't remember if that was ever resolved.
Yeah, well, and Robinson left the book, like, you know,
right,
12 issues in or whatever it was. So
I don't know if that was, I can't remember if that was only hinted at or like, I mean, very clearly more than hinted at. That's where things were going, but I don't remember them really exploring it all that much. If only there were some way to know.
Fine. It's fine. Not important enough for us to worry about.
But nonetheless, they're definitely returning to that same idea on the Prime Earth now. So
yes. Yes, which is a cool idea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you're going to make sense of all of that in terms of the green and the Guardians and all of that, but the idea that there is this power battery on Earth, and Tom uses a term that says that the Earth Lanterns make up a core, like basically the center of the Green Lantern Corps, and that this power battery can make new rings, and the first one it makes is for Hal, but they can make more rings in the future. And that is a really interesting idea, because for years there's this image in Lantern comics of a lantern dying and the ring flying off the hand and going to the next worthy person. We've never really seen, outside of, like, I know we've seen a character who forges rings, etc., but that's not been a real part of the sort of continuity of making new rings for people before. So I'm interested to see if Adams is going to pursue that down the road.
Yeah.
Talk about this for a bit.
Well, hang on. I just looked this up real quick, and yeah, it's pretty explicit that Alan Scott's ring is intrinsically connected to the green. It looks like that was pretty much resolved at the end of the first Robinson arc on on Earth 2, and then believe it or not, was revisited a little bit more in depth. Not only at the end of the run, apparently he resurrected himself thanks to the power of the green in like one of the last Earth 2 issues. Mm-hmm. But not only that, it was also heavily visited in Convergence, the Convergence event.
Of course.
Where apparently he drew upon the powers of the green to do various things that no one can remember, because no one really remembers that book. But
exactly.
Anyway, yeah. I mean, you said all the story reasons why this book is good, I think. Just the way that it, I mean, we've been doing this show long enough that people know that we, and particularly, especially speaking for myself, just love when DC lore is properly woven through everything. You know, I'm not somebody who minds progress or change being made to lore or retcons or anything like that, but I do really relish when creators go back and repurpose old concepts. And it's really what makes, to me, that's why you read all these comics. Outside of like the art and the writing, you know, like those are obvious basic reasons for why anyone enjoys art as entertainment, you know, but like the thing that makes comics special, the thing that makes a shared universe special is when you do that kind of thing, right? And so yes, this book has that in spades. So, you know, we kind of already talked about that, but the other thing I want to highlight is just Zermanico's art, who I've been a fan of for a while now. What was the book that kind of put Zermanico on the map for us? Do you remember?
I don't now, but shit, I should know this.
Yeah.
I keep talking. I'm looking it up. Keep talking.
Okay. Well, anyway, I just really like Zermanico's art. I think, you know, not only is the draftsmanship just kind of classically handsome work and pretty detailed. That's the one thing that always impresses me about Zermanico is that he stays on a schedule pretty well, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I never feel like detail is sacrificed. You know, I think his work always looks so consistent and good and detailed.
Was it Infinite Frontier?
That might be it. That might be it.
The miniseries Infinite Frontier.
Right. That was definitely... Yeah, I think that's right. He did some Justice League stuff too, but I can't remember whether that was before or after. Was that Snyder's Justice League? So it would have been after...
This was Venditti's Justice League, so yes, it would have been after.
God, I don't know.
No, I'm sorry. No, this would have been, I think, before.
No, it would have been after. It would have been after 2020.
Oh, okay.
2020 was Venditti. Infinite Frontier was... Oh, no, you're right. Infinite Frontier is 2021?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure that's not really that correct there.
I feel like that was... a lifetime ago.
I mean,
God, what is wrong with me?
It was a lifetime ago. Look at the fucking world we live in.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, just, you know, really want to restate how much I like Zermanico's art. I think Zermanico would have ate in the Geoff Johns era of Green Lantern, because there's one of my criticisms of that era is that, especially post Blackest Night, I felt like all Green Lantern was like this like messy space battle after space battle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Very little grounded storytelling, or at least it was dominated by like widescreen action scenes.
Sure.
And that's not to my taste. There are a couple pages, just a couple pages, where Zermanico gets to do that in this, which feels like enough to me. But they look awesome. There's one where like Hal is in the foreground and there's this big spaceship that's exploding and there's all these other lanterns and creatures flying around it. And, you know, it's this big double page epic space set piece, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, Johns was doing a lot of that. And this fits squarely in that aesthetic, even as the rest of the book is intent on being more grounded, which I appreciate. I like that more. But it's just to point out that I think, you know, Zermanico's good at doing both sides of what Green Lantern's all about, you know?
Yeah, there's a specific page I wanted to reference with Zermanico's art, which is the page where Hal charges up his ring for the first time. So I have this image, and I think it's probably Ethan Van Sciver, of a similar page where Hal is charging up his ring. And when they show him having charged it, there's like insane amounts of detail, and there's all this shit coming out of his ring, and it's supposed to show sort of the bombast and the power and all of that. And I understand all of that. But Zermanico's page is totally different. The last, there's a one page, you know, sort of almost pinup of Hal saying, "Beware my power, Green Lantern's light." And it's a very simple image of Hal holding one hand up and others at his side. And there's no desire to do more than needs to be done. Most of the panel is made up of light. It's just this bright green light coming from this newly charged ring. And it's such an understated moment where so many other creators would have done everything they can to make a meal out of that page. And I think the Zermatico is really good at picking his spots and not making everything try to be as huge and seemingly, you know, to put extra import on things that aren't there. You know, you mentioned how grounded this book is. I think part of the reason that Zermatico's art fits this book so well is that Zermatico knows when a panel doesn't need to be crazy over the top, but he also knows when it's time to really, you know, showcase something here.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's the discretion he has as an artist. I think is really impressive.
Yeah, that's well said. That's well said. That's one of the things, you know, like, again, personality and politics and whatever aside for EVS, that's one of the things that always bugged me about EVS's art, even though I think, like, there are times where he was good at spectacle, but he would always go way over the top. Yes. Not surprising considering who he is, but, like, you know, every character was like veins bulging in necks and like impossible, yes, like screaming and just awful detail in the muscles and all that stuff, you know, and, you know, I think there are pages and moments in that run that look good, but give me this every time over that.
Yes. Agreed. Agree completely. Anything else to say about the main story?
No, that's it for the, yeah. If we must talk about the backup.
Well, we must for two reasons. I'll talk about why in a second. But we should say that this ends with Hal being captured and then saved by Joe Mullen from a Far Sector.
Oh yeah.
And Joe is becoming a very important piece of the Green Lantern lore right now. And that is why we have talked about the backup, which is called The Trial of Jessica Cruz. It's written by Sam Humphries, illustrated by Yasmin Flores Montañez. And I think both of us commented in Lad's chat about how we have not missed the way Sam Humphries writes Jessica Cruz. And just Sam Humphries' general writing can be a bit much for us to take at times. But I will say, I like the overall shape of what they're doing with Jessica here. They've made her into a spy for Joe and whoever else Joe is working with. And so she is infiltrating the United Planets and showing that she is loyal to them while she is gathering information. And I just like the idea that after we've had the Green Lanterns scattered for a while and we haven't had anything that really feels like it's bringing them all together, I like that, A, these characters are coming together. You know, we saw last month the Kyle Rayner backup that ended with Joe showing up. And now we're getting Jessica Cruz and Joe showing up, and we see her showing up with Hal. I mean, with Joe showing up, yeah. And I just like that these characters are coming back together and that Joe is the catalyst for doing that. That's kind of all I have to say about this. The art is fine. I thought that the aliens had a good, like, 60s B-movie look to them. In some ways, I think there are some good panels in here, but it's not super attention grabbing artwork for me. But I generally thought it looked pretty good.
I agree. It does the job and it's clean. You know, I like,
yes,
I like a good, like, clean artist, especially if they're not going to have that, like, distinctive of a style, or they're going to hue pretty close to, like, what would be considered house style. I at least hope that it's, like, clean and clear, you know, and, yes, and this definitely is. Here's what I don't like about this, and everything you said is true. Like, Jessica's role in this is interesting, I guess, and like her being a spy, it is accomplished in the least credible way possible. Like,
sure.
I'm reading this and I'm going, there's, why would they take, after this, why would they take her in as somebody that works for them now? You know what I mean?
Right,
and at the
right.
end, she's at the end, she's on the phone with Joe, and she's like, they bought it. And I'm sure, like, maybe in a few issues or installments down the road, you're going to find that they didn't actually buy that she was, you know, they know she's a spy, but they're keeping her captive or whatever. Fine. That's fine. But in the context of this story, it is so unbelievable that they're like, yeah, you're in with us now. We're going to tell you all of our secrets. You know, like,
yeah.
I didn't buy any of that at all. Just because she like turns around and says like, I stand with the Lord of whatever this is.
Yeah.
Third planet. But so first of all, I didn't buy how the story got there. Even though I do agree that that's an interesting role for her. It's an interesting role for any of these lanterns to be put in, really. You know, she just happens to be the one they picked. But then just the only other thing, and it's minor, but it highlights like what I think is a writer just going through the motions, or like, I mean, forgive me, Sam Humphries, but did nobody step in and say, hey, don't do the record scratch joke? I bet you're wondering how I got here.
Right.
Record scratch. Like, it's 2024 now. That was funny online like 5 years ago, I think.
If then.
I think Trump was still in office when that was funny. There was so little to laugh at in those years. how Humphreys himself doesn't have the restraint to go, you know, that's hack. I should change that to something else. Again, it's minor, and but it's emblematic.
Maybe he's calling back to Rebirth of 2016. So
maybe
the online humor of the Rebirth era. Probably not.
Yeah. See, I don't like when they go back sometimes to old things.
Fair point.
I didn't like the writing, even if I do kind of like where the plot is going. It just felt like just very, very workmanlike, very like, that's one thing that I can't stand when comics writers do. And I feel like a lot of younger comics writers or students of Bendis and company will always do like the, oh, I'm so quirky dialogue, you know, like,
yeah,
like, so that's me flying through space, can you believe it, you know, that kind of thing.
Ugh.
I've had way too much of that. If you can't find an original angle using that sort of vernacular or tone, I just don't do it, you know, come up with something else. And there's nothing less original than the record scratch joke at this point. So anyway, enough of me shitting on that.
Hello, denizens of Earth 1218. We are the hosts of Make Mine Multiversity, a twice-monthly podcast. I'm Jaina.
And I'm Elias. Make Mine Multiversity is your handy guide to all things Marvel. Each month, we get into it with long looks at the careers of Marvel creators, characters, themes, whatever.
Sometimes that means we dig into all things X-Men, sometimes we do a book club for Marvel series past and present, and sometimes that means figuring out which series is our heavyweight champion.
Coming down by good old Skylaser to your podcatcher of choice every first and third Friday. Excelsior.
Excelsior indeed.
All right, well, let's move over to our second book of the week, which is Suicide Squad, Dream Team Number One. I keep wanting to call it Dreamer Squad, which is a bad title, but Dream Team is not great either. So
I keep wanting to call it the Dream Cream from Tim and Eric.
There we go. Speaking of Tim and Eric, check your texts.
What?
I sent you a Tim and Eric thing in text. Oh. We were talking before.
Oh, rest in peace,
Rest in
Prince
power,
John.
Richard Lewis. Yeah, exactly. Do you remember the name of the show that this is referencing?
No.
Just Three Boys.
Okay,
All right. Anyway, Suicide Squad Dream Team number one, written by Nicole Maines, illustrated by Eddie Barrows. The most notable thing about this is the countdown to absolute power banner on the top of it.
So we were planning on reading this book before, but when it actually ended up in our box and I saw that on the cover, nobody should be as excited as I was to see that banner. And that shows you like what a stupid mark I am at this point. But does that not, there's something about that it harkens back again to that like sweet pre-Flashpoint. That's not like countdown to that it looks different. It looks more like something that would have come from pre-Flashpoint
Yes.
like
No, it's
a new 52
definitely
event.
Countdown to Infinite Crisis vibes going for it here.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
I'm such an easy mark. Oh my God.
Well, I mean, so am I, but look, here's the thing. Part of this is, of course, nostalgia and whatever. But whenever I would see those Countdown to Whatever event banners, my number one thing that I would always pull from that is, oh, look, they have a plan. This is leading someplace. They have a plan. Look at this. They're building up to an event. I now know that's probably horseshit. And there's probably not a plan for all of this. But it still does give a little bit of that vibe to me, like they're trying to create a pathway for this event to work its magic on you.
Right.
And I appreciate that, even if it's probably not true.
Yeah, we talked about this offline a little bit, but it's a little bit of that DiDio Carnival Barker stuff that we've
Yes,
been missing
yes.
for a few years. It's so minor. I can't believe we're even talking about it, but it's true. Like, it's yeah, I there's something about it that just got the kid in me excited.
Yeah,
Again,
yeah.
I realize what a mark I sound like saying that.
Yeah. So here's the downside of this issue. And there is an upside to the issue that I will get to in a minute. But the downside of this issue is that anybody who's been paying attention at DC over the last year or two learned absolutely nothing from this comic. This is about as straight of a primer on who Dreamer is and what the Suicide Squad's all about as you're ever eligible to find. Like the whole reason this exists is to let people know that the Suicide Squad is a thing and that this is what Dreamer's whole deal is. And while that's not the worst thing in the world to have in a first issue of a series, it just feels like, and we've talked about this with Dreamer specifically before, how there is, we think that, I mean, I'll just speak for me. I don't want to speak for you, Vince, or for Zach with him not here, but I think that Dreamer is a character that has the potential to do really interesting things at DC because of a number of reasons. And every Dreamer story we get is this. It's a refresher on who Dreamer is and why we should be caring about her. And I just feel like that's not really benefiting anybody here. You know, by this point in the character's life, the character was introduced on the Supergirl television program, but has been a part of DC Comics for at least 2 years now. At this point in this character's life, we should be telling stories that aren't just origin retreads. And that's all this is. And that's my biggest beef with this comic. What say you?
Yeah, I think you're not wrong. Okay, you're not wrong, but here's what I would say. First of all, let me just say right up front, I'm surprised at how much I enjoyed this.
Okay.
I actually enjoyed this. Like, I don't think it's insanely great or anything, but and I'm not just saying that because of the kick-ass banner that's on the top of the cover. I swear I'm not. Everything that you said, I think, about Dreamer and her place in the DCU is more or less correct. It's things that I have echoed before on this show as well. First of all, I think this is the best issue of a comic that Maynes has written. I think I don't think the prior appearances of Dreamer were bad, but I think that they were fairly one note and kind of vanilla. And like you say, every time we saw her, it was a rehash kind of. I think this is the first comic where Maynes gets to stretch and write a bunch of characters that have unique voices. I enjoyed that. Was it Clock King?
Yes.
Yeah, Clock King was written as this basically written as like an online debate guy.
Right.
But not like it wasn't directly referencing like right-wing grievances. He was just came off as that kind of guy. Like, I think it was fairly smart writing to have, like, he's that type of guy without directly referencing like memes from the internet or whatever, you know?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
So I think like the writing is so much stronger than in prior Dreamer comics. And I do think you're right that it does re-explain Dreamer's deal. But I think one of our criticisms in the past was that Dreamer's power set, for lack of a better, less annoying term, was pretty nebulous and like not all that well defined. And we always found ourselves saying like, well, we didn't know she could do that. And like, I guess that's a thing now. But in this, I felt like, yes, they reestablish who Dreamer is, why you should care, blah, blah, blah. And then actually, within the context of Suicide Squad and Amanda Waller's mission here, you get a reason for her to have a power and to use it in a way that she seems essential to this team, right? That's well-defined, and that I hope, and this is the part where I'm hoping, because I don't think you're wrong, but I'm hoping that that means that in the rest of this miniseries and for whatever comes next, we actually get the story of Dreamer as she exists within the fabric of the DCU instead of kind of feeling like a reset every time we see her, you know?
I can agree with that. Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like, I'm not guaranteeing that's going to happen. I'm just saying that it feels, because this is the best written main story yet, and also because it seems to have momentum going into something else, I feel the best about this actually being something.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Absolutely. That absolutely makes sense. I'll also say that this book did something that I think is really good. A couple of things. I do want to say that I know Eddie Barrows is somebody we have both praised and critiqued on this show.
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes within the same comic.
Yes, but I think that this is actually a pretty good fit for Barrows, like character-wise and all that. I think this is a good fit for him. I'll get into Barrows a little bit more in a minute, but I think one of the things that the Suicide Squad tends to do is that, even though the whole idea of it is that it's not black and white, everything becomes very black and white in these comics, in that there's consequences to actions, but all the consequences are typically that the bad guys get what's coming to them. And what I liked about this was that the person that they travel through the dream of, that person dies, and everybody, but especially Dreamer, is pretty fucked up over that fact. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, wow, look at that. That's them actually giving a, you know, one of the things we've joked about in the past with Suicide Squad is that it's very, very easy to know what character is going to die in the Suicide Squad, because it's the least important character is going to get offed, you know, at some point in the issue. And so in this one, it's not a character, it's not a red shirt on the team at all. The first character we see that gets killed in the book is a kind of an innocent bystander. And I think that that is a powerful statement for a book that's supposed to be about collateral damage.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I would have forgotten if you didn't mention it. But that is because not only, as you say, not only is it easy to predict which Suicide Squad characters are going to be the fodder, but DC has been very careful, and it kind of goes unnoticed or not talked about, but they've been very careful about not showing, like, Harley is going to be on every incarnation of the Suicide Squad from now until we're in the grave, probably, right? Or at least 90% of them.
Yes.
But they're never going to show Harley kill somebody, right?
Right.
They're not going to show the characters that not only do they need to keep them alive, but they need to preserve the integrity of a lot of these characters too. They all have to have these. And I'm not saying this is, I'm not like being an edgelord that needs Harley Quinn to kill people. That's not what I'm saying.
Sure.
What I'm saying is that comics don't take those risks anymore, because as you get more and more fan favorite characters, you try to preserve them as anti-heroes more than villains, right? It's something we've talked about over the years where, like, Poison Ivy has ended up more anti-hero than villain, right?
Right, right.
Same with Harley, same with Clayface. In a vacuum, all of these stories can be very well written and good, and the intentions are good, and you know, it makes sense that, you know, you have these characters that fans get attached to for one reason or another, and you don't want to soil them by having them do something really awful. You know, I get the impulse there, but what you end up with are a bunch of Suicide Squad runs now that feel really low stakes, or like you can predict exactly where the stakes are, because, you know, well, you know, Harley's not going to kill somebody, or this person's not going to die. So I was really surprised, and pleasantly so, even though it's a grim, gruesome, like, upsetting thing that happens, that there was a fuck up and somebody actually died who shouldn't have, because of what this team did. And it immediately, I mean, this is fiction, I'm not, like, you know, but it gave it this, like, weighty stake that so many Suicide Squad books lack these days, I think.
Yes. Agreed completely.
Yeah. So sorry to hijack. You were saying some other stuff, I'm sure.
No, I was saying, I mean, that was the first thing I wanted to bring up about the book. Yeah. I also think that, like, it's a very interestingly constructed team of Task Force X members. I hope that we get some time with them before the team inevitably, like, shrinks down to a more manageable scale for the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think having, like, Black Alice there is interesting, and you mentioned Clock King. We're getting Bizarro, and it's always, you know, ever since the Red Hood and the Outlaws book, there's been this desire for me to have another sympathetic Bizarro to root for.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, this teases that a little bit. I think it's a fine team. And I think that the role that Harley plays here, I think she walks the line between it not being believably Harley Quinn and it being well-written Harley Quinn. And that is a really fine line to walk, because Harley is basically the voice of reason with Dreamer about sort of being in the Suicide Squad and what that means.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's really how Harley would act in this scenario, but it's not so egregious that it pulled me out of the book.
Yeah, it's, you're right. Exactly. I think, like, yeah, that scene where, see, that's why I think Nicole Maine's writing really has leveled up with this comic, I think, because it's exactly what you say. That scene could have played out and been so false, you know? And it really wasn't. And I love that the smartest piece of writing there, Brian, and I think this is what saves it from being false or from taking a false step, is when she says, "Is that why you're here? You think you're protecting folks?" So it's like Harley herself knows, like, oh, this person is deluding themselves into thinking that we're doing good here, you know?
Right. Yep.
And so she gets to maintain the, like, anti-hero sort of realist sense of what the Suicide Squad is, while being this, like, kind of somewhat comforting presence. It's her therapist side coming out, right?
Right. Like, that's a good call, yeah.
Yeah, that scene is so... Yeah, man, I don't want to overstate it, but, like, this is way better than the previous Dreamer story. And it's because now you got a stew going,
Brian. Rest in power, Carl Weathers.
Yeah, you throw Harley Quinn in there, you throw Clock King, Bizarro, you got a stew going with Dreamer now. Yeah.
And maybe part of the problem with the past Dreamer stories is that there just isn't enough to Dreamer yet to carry a standalone story. So having these other characters allows you to get the aforementioned Stu going a little bit better.
Yeah, and there was never even like a pretext of pretense of momentum with the character. You know, they would show up in an anthology story, no real sense of coming or going. You know.
Yeah.
Like what was next, whether it mattered in the grand scheme of things. Not that every story ever has to matter, and not that, you know, Dreamer is a good design and a good concept for a character, regardless of, but you need a story to put these characters in. You need an actual story, at least for someone like me, who, again, I'll reiterate, I'm a fan of the fabric of the DC universe, you know? So make her part of the fabric. And it feels like that could be happening.
Yeah, agreed.
I like it.
Agreed. I just want to do a couple quick notes about Eddie Barrows here, because we did talk about him very briefly before, which is that I really enjoyed Barrows' take on Bizarro here. I think that Bizarro is a character that in every artist's hands looks totally different.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed the way that Barrows drew Bizarro here. And I think overall, Barrows' tone for this, like I said, does fit the comic. You know, certain Barrow characters are going to be a little bit too lumpy at times. There's going to be a little bit of, like, Uncanny Valley at times. There's a little bit, sometimes a little bit too static, too posed. But overall, I think this does a pretty good job of walking the line that I think Barrows is best at, which is that there are times that Barrows is drawing something and I think, oh, this could fit in a 2000 AD story. And to me, that is where Barrows is doing his best work. So, you know, not the world's biggest Barrows fan, but I think this is a pretty decent assignment for the guy.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. There's a hint of the Barrows Tynion era Clayface in this.
Yes.
Bizarro, you know.
Yes.
The lumpiness of the head. And yeah. He's good at doing that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that does it for the show this week. We got a lot of mileage out of these two books.
Yeah.
What comes out next week, Vince?
Next week, we've got Batman 89, Echoes, number 2, Batman Superman, World's Finest, 25, Catwoman 63, DC's April Special, number 1.
Yeah, baby.
Green Lantern War Journal, number 7, Hellblazer, Dead in America, number 3, Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong, 6, Justice Society of America, number 9. Not sure I believe that, but
we Nightwing have a copy of it. We do.
We do. We do. Yeah. I do believe it. Nightwing 112, Superman 12, Titans 9, and Zach's favorite, Wonder Woman number 7.
Well, luckily Zach's not here again next week. He'll still be in the grave, so we cannot read that comic for next week. So
nor shall we. Let's be honest. We're reading the April special.
We're probably gonna read the April special in Justice Society. Does that sound good to you?
I guess, yeah.
Okay. The April special just sounds so nuts. Did you see that the April stuff is continuing in Batman Urban Legends, or the Batman Brave and the Bold, rather?
No, wait, come on.
Yeah, there's a Jurassic League story in that book in May.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I don't get it either, but it's happening, so we should read it, I guess.
I guess.
So until next week, if you want to go ape with us even more so, go to dc3cast.com for Patreon information, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
They do more like comedy / like oral shows, like
sure,
like
blowjob theater. I get it.
yeah, exactly. Donkey shows and things like that.